From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, journalist Stephen Kinzer talks about the CIA's secret experiments with LSD in the 50s and early 60s. The mission?
To try to figure out how to penetrate the human mind so it could be controlled in the interests of the United States government and its covert projects around the world.
Also, we hear from Tan France, the fashion expert on the series Queer Eye. When he got the call to audition for the show, he wanted to say no and avoid the pressure of being one of the first gay South Asian men from a Muslim family to be on TV. But he said yes.
After the show wrapped, I was racked with anxiety and guilt, thinking I'm about to destroy my community or the perception of my community.
And Ken Tucker reviews Ken Burns' PBS documentary series on the history of country music. First news.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Curio Collection by Hilton, inviting you to choose from a fascinating list of independent hotels around the world, each with its own story to tell. The Candler Hotel in Atlanta and the C. Baldwin in Houston are two of the collection's finest examples of repurposing history to create distinct experiences for their guests. Named after local legends, soda magnate Asa Griggs Candler and the mother of Houston, Charlotte Baldwin. Are you curious? Visit Hilton.com/NPR.
You may have heard stories about the CIA's secret experiments with LSD, through which 60s counterculture luminaries like Ken Kesey and Allen Ginsberg were first introduced to the drug. There's a lot more to the CIA's experiments with LSD, and some of it is pretty horrifying. My guest, journalist Stephen Kinzer, has spent several years investigating the CIA's mind control program, which was known as MKUltra. LSD was just one of the mind-altering drugs that were tested in the program to see if and how they could be weaponized to control human behavior. Many of the unwitting subjects of these experiments were subjected to what amounts to psychological torture. The MKUltra program was created by Sidney Gottlieb in 1953. He ran it until it was shut down in the early 60s. Gottlieb was also the CIA's chief chemist, creating poisons and innovative ways of surreptitiously administering them. He also became head of the CIA program that creates high-tech gadgets for spies to use. Stephen Kinzer's new book is called Poisoner-in-Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. One of Kinzer's previous books was about the Dulles brothers, Allen and John Foster Dulles. Allen Dulles was the CIA director during most of the years MKUltra was in operation. Stephen Kinzer, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with, what was the mission of MKUltra?
During the early period of the Cold War in the late 40s and early 1950s, the CIA became paralyzed with a fear that communists had perfected some kind of a drug or a potion or a technique that would allow them to control human minds. This was actually a greatly exaggerated fear, but it played on something cultural that affected everybody that grew up in the early 20th century. We were fed a lot of books and movies about the idea of mind control, that you could hypnotize someone or give someone a drug that would make them do something that otherwise they would never do. And seized by this myth, the CIA not only believed that communists had approached or reached this holy grail, but that the CIA should also find out a way to do it. So MKUltra was a project lasting up to 10 years in which the CIA sought to find ways to control the human mind. They wanted to be able to have a truth serum that would make prisoners say everything they knew, also an amnesiac that would make people forget what they had done, and most important, a technique or a drug that would allow the CIA to direct agents to carry out acts like sabotage or assassination, and then forget who had ordered them to do it, or even that they had carried out the actions at all. So MKUltra was the most sustained search in history for techniques of mind control.
So LSD was created in 1943 by Dr. Albert Hofmann at the Sandoz Laboratories in Basel, Switzerland. How did the CIA find out about LSD?
As part of the search for drugs that would allow people to control the human mind, CIA scientists became aware of the existence of LSD, and this became an obsession for the early directors of MKUltra. Actually, the MKUltra director, Sidney Gottlieb, can now be seen as the man who brought LSD to America. He was the unwitting godfather of the entire LSD counterculture. In the early 1950s, he arranged for the CIA to pay $240,000 to buy the world's entire supply of LSD. He brought this to the United States, and he began spreading it around to hospitals, clinics, prisons, and other institutions, asking them through bogus foundations to carry out research projects and find out what LSD was, how people reacted to it, and how it might be able to be used as a tool for mind control. Now, the people who volunteered for these experiments and began taking LSD, in many cases, found it very pleasurable. They told their friends about it. Who were those people? Ken Kesey, the author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, got his LSD in an experiment sponsored by the CIA, by MKUltra, by Sidney Gottlieb. So did Robert Hunter, the lyricist for the Grateful Dead, which went on to become a great purveyor of LSD culture. Allen Ginsberg, the poet who preached the value of the great personal adventure of using LSD, got his first LSD from Sidney Gottlieb, although, of course, he never knew that name. So CIA brought LSD to America unwittingly. And actually, it's a tremendous irony that the drug that the CIA hoped would be its key to controlling humanity actually wound up fueling a generational rebellion that was dedicated to destroying everything that the CIA held dear and defended.
Even Timothy Leary, who turned a lot of people onto LSD and helped guide them through trips, he found out about LSD because of Sidney Gottlieb. He wasn't part of one of the experiments, but what's the connection?
You're absolutely right. Tim Leary, who became the great guru of LSD, first came across psychedelics through Sidney Gottlieb, although, like all these other people, he had never heard Gottlieb's name because Gottlieb lived in complete invisibility. So Tim Leary's interest in psychedelic drugs was sparked by an article that appeared in Life magazine in 1957. It was about a couple of Americans who had gone to Mexico and found the magic mushroom that produces hallucinations. Leary was fascinated by this. He later went to Mexico, and before he ever tried LSD, he was using those magic mushrooms. What he did not know and had no way of knowing is that that expedition to Mexico that produced the Life magazine article was paid for by Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA. It was part of his effort to test all kinds of substances, including naturally occurring ones like shrubs and trees and barks and mushrooms and fish parts and animal pieces, as possible tools for mind control. So it's not surprising that later on in life, Tim Leary said the entire LSD movement was started by the CIA. If he had known better, he would have said it was founded by the CIA and, in particular, Sidney Gottlieb.
So just so I understand this correctly, so the CIA basically set up phony philanthropic foundations, which then funded university and college research. And it's through those research experiments that people like Ginsberg and Kesey and Robert Hunter got introduced to LSD. And the university researchers had no idea that their research was actually being funded by the CIA.
I think that's largely correct. So Stanford University was running a program in which they asked for volunteers to come in and try this new substance. Allen Ginsberg was one of the volunteers. So was Robert Hunter. A similar set of experiments was going on at the Menlo Park Veterans Administration Hospital. That's where Ken Kesey took LSD for the first time. He was so excited about it, he took a job in the hospital and began stealing the LSD to give it to his friends. That became the basis for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's nest. So all of these original strands that came together in the 60s to produce this great countercultural revolt based around LSD can be traced back through these bogus foundations to the CIA and ultimately the director of MKUltra, Sidney Gottlieb.
Now, there's a much darker side to this program, because a lot of people who were being experimented on, they were prisoners. I mean, they had no idea what they were being given. One of those prisoners was the famous gangster Whitey Bulger, who was serving time then for hijacking a truck, and he was in the Atlanta penitentiary. So he actually wrote something describing his experience. Can you give us a summary of what he said?
Whitey Bulger was one of the prisoners who volunteered for what he was told was an experiment aimed at finding a cure for schizophrenia. As part of this experiment, he was given LSD every day for more than a year. He later realized that this had nothing to do with schizophrenia, and he was a guinea pig in a government experiment aimed at seeing what people's long-term reactions to LSD was. Essentially, could we make a person lose his mind by feeding him LSD every day over such a long period? Bulger wrote afterward about his experiences, which he described as quite horrific. He thought he was going insane. He wrote, I was in prison for committing a crime, but they committed a greater crime on me. And towards the end of his life, Bulger came to realize the truth of what had happened to him. And he actually told his friends that he was going to find that doctor in Atlanta who was the head of that experiment program in the penitentiary and go kill him. Now, that doctor later died a natural death, so Bulger didn't get to carry out his wish. But Bulger was one of many prisoners across America who unwittingly were fed huge doses of LSD. And the reason for this was very simple. Gottlieb wanted to create a way to seize control of people's minds. And he realized it was a two-part process. First, you had to blast away the existing mind. Second, you had to find a way to insert a new mind into that resulting void. Well, he didn't get too far on number two, but he did a lot of work on number one, trying to find out how to destroy the mind of a human being. And that was the purpose of experiments that he carried out in prisons in the United States and at secret detention centers in Europe and East Asia.
And he worked with some pretty high-class torturers, too, from one of the Nazi doctors and the chief poisoner from Japan during World War II. How did they end up in his program?
One of the most remarkable discoveries that I made in the research for this book is that the CIA mind control project, MKUltra, was essentially a continuation of work that began in Japanese and Nazi concentration camps. Not only was it roughly based on those experiments, but the CIA actually hired the vivisectionists and the torturers who had worked in Japan and in Nazi concentration camps to come and explain what they had found out so that we could build on their research. For example, Nazi doctors had conducted extensive experiments with mescaline at the Dachau concentration camp. And the CIA was very interested in figuring out whether mescaline could be the key to mind control. That was one of their big avenues of investigation. So they hired the Nazi doctors who had been involved in that project to advise them. Another thing the Nazis provided was information about poison gases like sarin, which is still being used. Nazi doctors came to America to Fort Detrick in Maryland, which was the center of this project, to lecture to CIA officers to tell them how long it took for people to die from sarin. And was there a difference in how long it took to die if you were a small child or an infant, whether you were an elderly person or whether you were a healthy middle-aged person? The only way to know this would be to have killed all those people. The CIA was eager to get this kind of information. And actually, one of the things that is the most bizarre about the fact that we relied on Nazi doctors is that Sidney Gottlieb himself was Jewish and his parents had emigrated from Central Europe in the early 20th century. If they had not emigrated, Sidney Gottlieb might well himself have been brought up in Central Europe, forced into a ghetto, brought to a concentration camp, and become the subject of one of these grotesque Nazi medical experiments. Nonetheless, he didn't seem to have any problem working as a CIA officer with the doctors who conducted those experiments.
Yeah, I found that pretty hard to understand. But, you know, also, Kurt Blohm, one of the Nazi doctors who was hired by Sidney Gottlieb, was on trial in Nuremberg. He was acquitted, but he was one of the Nazi doctors who was tried. And the Nuremberg Code established that if you are conducting experiments, that the person you are experimenting on needs to give informed consent. And of course, MKUltra totally violated the Nuremberg Code, but apparently the U.S. never signed on to that, never adapted that.
If the United States had used the Nuremberg Code domestically, Sidney Gottlieb would never have been able to do what he did. There couldn't have been MKUltra. What Sidney Gottlieb did is exactly what we sentenced Nazi doctors to death after the Second World War for doing in concentration camps.
My guest is Stephen Kinzer. His new book is called Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. We'll talk more after a break, and Ken Tucker will review Ken Burns' new PBS documentary series on the history of country music. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the American Jewish World Service, working together for more than 30 years to build a more just and equitable world. Learn more at ajws.org.
Let's get back to my interview with Stephen Kinzer about his new book, Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. In the 50s and early 60s, Gottlieb headed the secret CIA program MKUltra, which conducted experiments to see if LSD and other mind-altering drugs could be weaponized as a form of mind control. Gottlieb was also the CIA's chief chemist, creating poisons and unusual ways of surreptitiously administering them should they be needed to kill enemies, including world leaders. And he headed the program that created high-tech gadgets for spies. So this is just a little sidebar that I found very interesting as somebody who listens to a lot of jazz. The people who Sidney Gottlieb hired included George Hunter White, who directed a lot of the MKUltra experiments, and he had been a narcotics agent and led the Narcotics Bureau's campaign against jazz in New York City. He spied on musicians and entrapped them, including Billie Holiday. And Billie Holiday being busted was a turning point in her career because she couldn't get a cabaret license. There were places she couldn't perform in. It was a really tragic thing for her. And that's this guy.
George Hunter White was one of the key operatives of MKUltra, and he stands out even in this extremely bizarre MKUltra cast of Nazi doctors and torturers and obsessed chemists. So George Hunter White, as you say, was a narcotics agent in New York. But he was the kind of narcotics agent who not only lived at the edge of the law, he crossed over a lot. He used all the substances that he confiscated from people. His use of alcohol and narcotics was legendary. But he was also a cop who did pursue jazz figures, including Billie Holiday. He had a special dislike for her because he said the way that she flaunted her furs and her big cars was offensive to him.
Wow.
In the early 1950s, Gottlieb hired this guy, George Hunter White, to run a safe house for him in New York City, to which people would be lured off the street and then given LSD so CIA officers could watch them from an adjoining apartment through a one-way mirror. Later, White was moved to San Francisco, where he set up one of the craziest MKUltra projects that was known inside the agency as Operation Midnight Climax. This was an operation in which White would assemble a stable of prostitutes who would bring their men back to an apartment that the CIA hired and furnished, feed them LSD, and George Hunter White would sit in an adjoining apartment, sitting on a portable toilet, drinking pitchers of martinis while watching people having sex under the influence of LSD with the vague idea that this was somehow going to help the United States defeat communism. So these were the kind of people that naturally gravitate to a project like this one.
When the men were having sex with prostitutes and were unknowingly given doses of LSD, weren't they then asked questions to see what their answers would be like under LSD?
Exactly. So White and the people who worked with him would prep these prostitutes, and they would say, we want to find out under what circumstances, under what combination of sex and drugs, men would be most likely to reveal secrets. So we want you to stay with the guy after the thing is over and talk to him and try to draw him out about his work and ask him, for example, you know, that plane you've been working on, so how high does it fly, really? And the idea was to try to draw out information and to see whether drugs could make people talk. And of course, they found out things that are very obvious, that people will talk, men will talk after sex. And the people who were observing these experiments, like George Hunter White, had no background in psychology or anything that would allow them to assess these situations in a clinical way. Everything was very slapdash and haphazard. So, not surprisingly, no serious results ever came out of this, except the fact that we can now sit here and talk about the fact that our tax dollars were used to pay for a bordello run by the CIA in San Francisco, to which unwitting men were brought, fed LSD, and used as experiments in Sidney Gottlieb's campaign to try to figure out how to penetrate the human mind so it could be controlled in the interests of the United States government and its covert projects around the world.
So Sidney Gottlieb's MK Ultra program was ended in the early 1960s. Why was it ended?
After all the experiments that led to deaths in unknown numbers around Europe and Asia and led to unknown torments across the United States, Gottlieb, who was in the end a scientist, was forced to reach the conclusion that he had failed. Mind control, he finally came to conclude, is a myth. It was fed by fantasies from fiction that these people had imbibed at a young age. But once you got to see if you could transfer those fantasies from the realm of fiction to the realm of reality, they broke down. So Gottlieb finally had to admit he never could find a way to control human minds. And what skeptics had said at the beginning, which is that you cannot program a person to do something that he or she is basically and deeply and morally opposed to doing and make them go out and do it. He had to waste unknown numbers of lives in order to reach a conclusion that should have been clear from the beginning.
Well, Stephen Kinzer, thank you for this book. I found the revelations in it really remarkable. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Stephen Kinzer is the author of the new book, Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. Ken Burns has found a new subject for one of his long-form documentaries. The filmmaker who has explored everything from the Civil War to the Central Park Five now gives us 16 hours about the history of country music. It airs in 8 parts on PBS. Rock critic Ken Tucker has some thoughts about this massive project. Let's start with this clip in which Roseanne Cash explains the source of one of her father Johnny Cash's biggest hits, I Walk the Line.
As sure as night is dark and day is light, I keep you on my mind both day and night.
The song came from my mother's fear. You know, you're going out on the road and these girls are coming up and to you, and he wrote, I Walk the Line. I'm going to stay true to you.
Ken Burns is our great explainer, television's finest illustrator, a filmmaker who gives us what we know from fresh angles so that we can learn more, appreciate on a deeper level. Whether his subject is the Civil War or baseball, Burns has made an art of divining what most Americans know about a subject and then putting an arm around our collective shoulder and murmuring, yes, but have you seen this? Burns's new subject is country music. You'd think it would be a relatively easy challenge. Beyond the common wisdom that Hank Williams was country music's first great songwriter, there's a lot the average citizen doesn't know about the music's history, and getting footage of performers singing is more readily available than, say, film of Ty Cobb spiking a third baseman. And indeed, there are many entertaining moments in Ken Burns' country music, such as this one, when Dolly Parton describes leaving the singing partner who launched her career, Porter Wagoner, in 1974, and the source of one of her biggest hits.
When I was trying to leave the show, I had told Porter I'd stay 5 years. It had been five, then it was six, then it was seven. He was just having a real hard time because it was going to mess up his show. We were very bound and tied together in so many emotional ways, and he just would not hear of it. And so he was going to sue me. He was going to do this. He was going to do that. And so I went home. I thought, he's not going to listen to me because I've said it over and over. And so I thought, do what you do best. Just write a song. So I wrote the song, took it back in the next day, and I said, Porter, sit down. I got something I have to sing to you. So I sang it, and he was sitting at his desk, and he was crying. He said, that's the best thing you ever wrote. Okay, you can go, but only if I can produce that record. And he did, and the rest is history.
Released a few months after she left, it would go on to become Dolly Parton's best-selling song.
If I should stay,
Ken Burns' country music begins in the 1920s with engineer-producer Ralph Peer recording country artists for the first time and continues on in 8 2-hour episodes up through the 1990s, at which point Burns seems to throw up his hands and quit before entering the 21st century and being obliged to explain Taylor Swift. This production, narrated by Peter Coyote, is also full to bursting with interviews with country music stars. They talk about themselves and lavish praise on each other. Pretty soon, all the back-scratching becomes tiresome. 18 years ago, Burns gave us the history of jazz with the help of on-camera perspective by critics such as Albert Murray, Stanley Crouch, and Gary Giddens. Ken Burns doesn't seem to think country music holds up to such scrutiny. How else to explain the presence of only one country music scholar, Bill C. Malone? To be sure, some performers, notably Marty Stewart and Roseanne Cash, are eloquent in their grasp of country music complexity. But where is context and commentary from critics and historians like, say, Julie Height or Holly Gleason, whose books have done so much to rewrite country history to include essential female voices? In place of scholarship here, there is gush. And compliments don't get much more inarticulate than Kris Kristofferson on Waylon Jennings.
I've been a fool. I've been a fool.
He sang as good as Hank Williams, and he's really a good songwriter. His voice was what tore me up, though. It's just like the way Hank Williams tore me up.
I've been a long time leaving, but it'll be a long time.
He could sing songs that I can't.
There are also times when some of Burns' best notions aren't well executed. The second hour has a promising section about the comedian Minnie Pearl, a woman too often neglected in surveys such as this. Yet, after establishing that this marvelous humorist was a college-educated wit whose cornpone stage image was a carefully crafted persona, the documentary then fails to show us any video example of her at work. She was one of the most frequent and energetic guest stars on TV variety shows stretching from the 1950s through the 1980s, yet she's tucked away here with only a miserable bit of audio. I was dumbfounded. In general, Burns and his writer, Dayton Duncan, present what used to be called the great man theory of history, the biggest stars and the most obvious ideas are the ones deemed most worthy.
Country music is a complicated chorus of American voices, joining together to tell a complicated American story. It has been handed down from generation to generation, moving from farm fields and churches and family porches into every corner of the country.
I said to the undertaker, undertaker, please drive slow, for this lady you are carrying, Lord, I hate to see her go.
It has changed and grown at every turn, tethered to its past, but always reaching toward its future.
2 years ago, in his series The Vietnam War, Ken Burns deepened our knowledge of that country's history, giving Americans a new perspective from which to view the war. But in country music, Burns goes wide, not deep. It's rare for any musical excerpt to last more than 20 seconds, making it impossible for a singer to make an impression on a viewer unfamiliar with the work. This time around, Ken Burns has traveled down Hank Williams' Lost Highway with a busted GPS.
Ken Tucker reviewed the new Ken Burns PBS series on the history of country music. Coming up, we hear from Tan France, the fashion expert on the Netflix series Queer Eye. When the show won an Emmy, he said, "I never expected a Pakistani boy would be winning an Emmy for being on a show about being openly gay." This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from WHYY, presenting The Pulse, a podcast that takes you on adventures into unexpected corners of health and science. Plastic in the guts of deep sea creatures, crying after anesthesia, building your own internet. Each episode is full of fascinating stories and big ideas. The Pulse, available where you get your podcasts or at WHYY.org.
My guest, Tan France, is the fashion expert on the Netflix series Queer Eye. When the show received an Emmy, he said, "I never expected a Pakistani boy would be winning an Emmy for being on a show about being openly gay." Tan France grew up in a small town in northern England, the son of Pakistani immigrants. He says, "Our home wasn't super religious, but we had a profound connection to our Muslim heritage." France's husband was raised in a Mormon family on a ranch in Wyoming. They now live in Salt Lake City. In France's new memoir, Naturally Tan, he writes about growing up gay and Muslim and how eventually he learned to express himself through clothes. On each episode of Queer Eye, France and the show's four other experts try to help people improve their lives by helping them with their wardrobe, cooking, personal grooming, and the interior design of their home or business. It's not just advice. The show has the budget to buy the clothes and redesign interiors. The series is a reboot of Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, which was a makeover show for straight men. But the new series has expanded to include a more diverse set of subjects, including women and LGBTQ people. Tan France, welcome to Fresh Air. So you're the clothing and fashion expert on Queer Eye, and you've been in the fashion biz as a designer. Tell us what you had to wear when you were growing up at home and at school.
Hi, Terry Gross. I had to wear preferably something called shalwar kameez, which is a long tunic and harem pants. However, my mom was relatively liberal, and so she would let me play around a little at home with my attire. And at school, I had to wear a school uniform. However, we had Fridays where we could wear whatever we wanted. So they, my mom and dad provided a lot of clothing that was Western but not technically school uniform. So I was able to dress up every now and then at home in a way that definitely wasn't considered modest. I've got air quotes. The reason why we wear shalwar kameez at home is because it protects your modesty.
Describe what it looks like. People will recognize it from your description.
Sure. It's a long tunic that goes down to your knees. It's very boxy. It hides your form. And then you wear a harem pant underneath, which is one size fits all, and it's an elasticated waist, and the legs taper down to the hem. It's quite honestly, it's not flattering, but it's not meant to be flattering. It's not meant to be sexy or cool. It's meant to be modest and to protect your modesty. It's not usually in a flashy color. It's usually in a very subdued color. And so it's simple clothing. That is culturally appropriate for Pakistanis. It's not necessarily clothing that is desperately needed for a Muslim. There are many options that you can wear as a Muslim that aren't necessarily shalwar kameez, but have to be modest. However, in the Pakistani and Indian culture, a shalwar kameez is what we go for.
You know, yeah. The shalwar kameez is a kind of flowy set of garments. And, you know, in Western culture, like, flowy garments are considered very feminine.
Yes.
Which is not what they're meant to convey.
No,
actually, Pakistani culture. Yeah.
No, the shalwar kameez is definitely something that is a sign of refinement and sophistication for a man. There is a woman's version also, but they are usually a lot more colorful. But no, there's definitely, it's not seen as effeminate at all. If you were to wear more Western clothing, that's seen as quite effeminate, even though that would be our version now in the West. A suit would be the ultimate armor for a man, the ultimate sartorial choice for a real man. But that definitely wasn't the case in my culture.
Wait, are you telling me that jeans and a t-shirt would be considered feminine?
Yeah, because you're showing so much of your body, which is in my culture, definitely in my family, is more of a feminine trait.
Huh.
Why would you want to show off your bum?
Right. Okay. Confusing, isn't it?
Unless it's a Laura Mann. Yes.
So your parents are from Pakistan. You were born in England in a small English town in South Yorkshire.
Yeah. Actually, one slight correction. I don't actually articulate this in the book, but my mum's family is from India and Kashmir, and my dad's family is from Pakistan.
Uh-huh. Thank you for clarifying that. It was kind of dangerous to be Pakistani when you were growing up in England, at least in your town. And you write that you weren't even allowed out of the house after school hours because it was dangerous. Were you beaten up a lot?
Yes. Not beaten up. I guess it depends on your definition of beaten up with the listeners. You'd get slapped around a little bit or punched in the face or punched in the gut, but it wasn't really a beating. It was just a quick hit and then they move on. But as a kid, it was really hard to handle because I didn't have the understanding, really. At the age of 5 or 6, when you get hit for your skin color, it makes no sense because you don't see that as a problem. Violence was ever present in my life. That was something I never escaped, and I just saw it as normal. And I remember, I don't remember if I wrote this in the book, but I remember saying this to my husband, that I was never bullied as a kid. And then I would talk about my childhood and he was like, you've said you've never been bullied, but that absolutely is bullying. The strange thing is we never saw it as bullying. It was just a matter of fact.
So you were targeted because you're Pakistani, and I'm sure being gay made that only more difficult.
You know, the interesting thing is, Terry, I don't think anyone ever noticed. I think that they were just so consumed with my color that they just seemed to lose sight of the fact that I was also homosexual. Also, I learned from a young age to hide it. Well, I really played mask as much as I possibly could because there were a couple of things that happened as a kid that I knew were problematic for my family. And so I learned very early on that those feminine traits needed to be quashed. And so nobody ever really caused me any problems outside of the home because they thought that I was gay. I don't think anyone even assumed that at any point.
Your parents might have had no gaydar at all.
They had that's not a question. They had no gaydar whatsoever. I remember when I first talked to my mom about it and I said the word, and she truly had never heard the word before. And when I explained what it was as if I was explaining an alien race to her. Mm-hmm. She wasn't disrespectful. She wasn't rude about it. She was flabbergasted. She had never heard of such a thing because she'd never watched. We call it white TV, which I know is so offensive, but we call it white TV or English TV, even though it wasn't. It was usually American shows that we would watch in secret. But my parents never saw that because my mom didn't speak English super well when I was a child. So she would only watch Pakistani TV, and there was never a gay storyline in any of those shows. So she was, shocked when I finally said, okay, there's a whole community of people that you've never understood, you've never even heard of. Let me explain this to you.
There was a period when you had three fashion mm-hmm. businesses, mm-hmm. and it got so stressful. You say you became depressed and nearly suicidal. So you sold your businesses, and just a few weeks later, you got a call from Queer Eye, basically asking you to audition for it.
Yeah.
But what in between selling your business and getting the call from Queer Eye, what did you see ahead for yourself?
So part of the reason why it wasn't so difficult to let the businesses go was because I've always wanted to be a father. I've wanted children since I was 1920. Like, if I had had a stable relationship at that time, I would have desperately tried to have children. And so I'd already put it off for so long. At that point, I was 33, or about to become 33. And so I was going to sell my businesses and start to have children with my husband. That costs a heck of a lot. Surrogacy for gay men costs a heck of a lot. And so I was going to use the money to start that process. And I was going to be a stay-at-home dad, which is something I've wanted for many, many, many years. And so that was for the plan. And I crazily, I still want six. I don't know if that's going to happen, but I still want six children.
Wow. So you, after you sold your businesses, you got the call from Queer Eye. And
5 days later.
Wow, it wasn't weeks, it was days. Yeah. Yeah. And you didn't want to do it. You didn't want to talk to them even. Why not?
No. So I'd sold the final business. My husband and I, his name is Rob. Rob and I went to Vegas. We frequent Vegas, which is funny because neither of us drink, smoke, dance, or gamble, but we love Vegas. The weather's real nice and it's nice and close. So we went on a mini trip to Vegas to celebrate the sale of the businesses. And I got a call from a friend of a friend, and he was helping find somebody for the show Queer Eye. And he wanted me to chat with the casting director. And I said, no, that's definitely not for me. I'm not a showbiz, but this person, I'm about to retire and I'm going to have children. And he said, they really want to talk to you. One of them saw your Instagram post. I did a final post on one of my businesses, and they want to talk to you about it. They think that you could be great. They've seen you on camera. I was like, no, definitely not for me.
How did they describe the reboot to you?
They didn't. At that point, they didn't. They just said it's we're remaking Queer Eye for the straight guy. It's called Queer Eye and it's going to be on Netflix. And so It wasn't for me, and I'll say why. So I didn't want to be on a show anyway. I didn't want to become famous. That wasn't really the life for me, and I didn't necessarily need the funds. I didn't think I wanted to be on Queer Eye. I wasn't necessarily about making things pretty. That wouldn't have been what enticed me to join show business. And so when I had the actual call with the casting director, they explained what it was, and the direction was so different to what the original show was. And I'm not trying to be disrespectful or denigrate the original show at all. I loved the original show. And I used to watch the original show, the British iteration of it, and it was wonderful. It was playful. But the plan that they had for this version of the show was to connect people and to have them see a version of people that they probably never connected with before or communicated with before. And I just thought that could be really interesting for me. I have struggled with this for many, many years, people seeing my people as troublesome or a threat. And I could have an opportunity to change the narrative for my people. And so that's why I decided to take the actual audition.
I don't know how observant you are now as a Muslim, but did you have any feelings that maybe being so openly gay and being on TV on a gay show would be going against your faith? Like, did you feel like you were betraying your own principles at all, being so out?
Oh,
and
no.
Gay? You know,
I reconciled that when I was a child.
How did you do that? Because I think for a lot of people, that's really hard.
It is. Thankfully, I had belief in the God that I had been raised to believe in, that he was the most peaceful and most loving. And I, even at the early age of 11 or 12, when I really started to understand that I would never marry a woman, that if I were to marry, it would be a man, I couldn't imagine, I couldn't figure in my mind at any point that the God that I was raised to love would send me to eternal hellfire for purely loving someone else.
Mm-hmm. You've been with your husband, Rob, for 10 years. How many of those years have you been married?
So actually, we've been together 11 years now. And that when I wrote the book, it was 10. So yeah, we've been together 11 years now. We've been married for 9.5.
Good.
So, and it's bliss. Blissful. I mean, you've read the book, you know how much I go on about my husband. I could write 10 books about how much I love my husband. He's the most impressive man I know.
So you grew up in a Muslim Pakistani family in England, whereas your husband Rob grew up in Wyoming on a ranch in a Mormon family.
Yes.
So your background is Muslim, his background is Mormon. One of the things that's so interesting, the way you describe it in your book, is that when you met each other, and this was through like an early version of what we'd now call a dating app,
yes,
you were so thrilled that he too was raised in a non-alcoholic environment, and like you, he did not drink.
Yes. So, yeah.
Why did that mean so much to you?
So, being from England, I had never met a gay guy that didn't drink and do much more. And I always struggled with it. I wasn't a drinker. I didn't come from a home where alcohol was allowed. And so I started to drink with my boyfriends, even though I hated it, just to feel like I was fitting in with that crowd, and I never really enjoyed it. And I always hoped that I could meet somebody who didn't drink alcohol, but that just was so unlikely. Like, that person would be a unicorn in England. If you are gay, you go out and you drink. And so I thought that was my lot in life, and I knew that I was always going to be relatively unhappy in a relationship if I was dating somebody that drank. And so then when I finally met Rob, I finally came to Utah and I learned of these Mormon people who didn't drink alcohol, I was shocked that there were Caucasian people out there that didn't drink alcohol. And then I met Rob, and it fit me perfectly, because his lifestyle was quite similar to mine as a kid. Yes, we lived worlds apart. Yes, he was on a ranch. Yes, I was in a town in England. But his day-to-day with his family was actually quite similar to mine. And still to this day, neither of us drink alcohol, neither of us smoke, neither of us take drugs, or we don't eat pork. Our understanding of each other's life is very easy because we both practice the same way. And it's not that either of us practice a religion, but we just have those things that we don't do from our childhood that we never really then started to play with or experiment with, because it wasn't part of the life that we lived as children. And so it makes for a much smoother relationship for us. I can't imagine at this point being with somebody who drank. It just isn't. All my friends do, and it's not a concern at all. But as far as my partner, I want him to be in line with who I am. And so it makes for a much stronger connection for me. And so the Mormon religion is quite different from mine, but I'm so grateful for it, because it has created a marriage for me that is so happy.
Well, you both came from religions that were kind of restrictive.
Yes. Yes. And I think that one may assume that may be difficult for us, that we might want to rebel. But that, and we know many people within our faiths that have done that. They've gone the complete opposite way, and they drink a lot. They take a lot of drugs. They are in nightclubs every night, and so be it. But thankfully for me, I found somebody that connected with me so strongly and didn't do any of that. We both still held on so strongly to certain parts of our religion.
Dan Franz, it's just been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Terry. This honestly has been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Dan Franz is the fashion expert on the Netflix series Queer Eye. His new memoir is called Naturally Tan. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Roberta Shorrock, Muj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.